Test.
All right, we're back to Deep Thoughts here on MKUltra Radio. So, you know, I sit around and I think about these episodes after I do them, and ayahuasca, there I said it right. And I try to find, you know, some sort of subject in the mezzanine between what we are accustomed to talking about, such that I talk about things that aren't trite, you know, things that are fresh, things that are actually have value that no one ever talks about. And I find that in a world where divorce is almost a certainty, kids miss upbringing. They miss it from their parents. Depending on how they're raised, they may not have grandparents or whatever, or because we've all adopted so much thought police and so much, you know, PC behavior that we typically don't communicate about those little things in life that make all the difference in the world. The things that give you opportunities, the things that take away your opportunities. And today we're going to talk about communicating, because I've had a really interesting experience with communicating. By the way, I fiddle with this microphone. I used to think when I was a kid that people liked to touch their microphones. Every time a performer went up, they'd start adjusting the microphone. It always bothered me, especially comedians or something like that. No, it's just, there's a weird proximity of this mic that just, you only can hear my voice if I'm really close to it. It's part of my regimen to communicate with you. Once it's set up, I don't need to touch it. But the subject of communicating has hit me at several different times in my life, and I've had enlightenment from so many weird areas that I thought that I'll pass it on to you guys, because a lot of times when someone would intentionally try to improve my communication, I would reject them. Not conscious, I mean, not verbally to them, but inside my mind, I was, you know, I knew everything, and I was a great everything, and da-da-da, whatever, the typical ego of a child. And I realized that I do something, and I think everyone does this, especially kids, where they deny what you, they deny that you the reward of giving them some knowledge that actually works. And I don't mean a reward as in thank you, daddy or mommy. I mean in actually visibly using your advice right away. But in the end, they hear what you say and they end up using it. And that's what I always did as a young kid, my teens and maybe a couple of years in my early 20s. And then I finally pulled my head out and started using the knowledge freely and looking for more knowledge and looking for more mentorship. I've mentioned a couple times on various deep thoughts and essays that there have been people in my life that have really inspired me to behave in a certain way. From how I walk down the street, to how I communicate, to the words I choose. And I'm constantly making mistakes in these areas against my own principles and my own guidelines. But I wanted to share with you, again, some of my stories about how I figured out how to communicate with people. And ironically, those who don't communicate well will probably shut this off. But for those of you who are interested in maybe comparing notes, I mean, most of this stuff is just comparing notes. You may have it all right, and you may have it way better than I do. If you do, please pass it back to me, because I could always use good advice. Sometimes a sentence is worth everything when you get into these subjects like communicating. When I was, I'm going to go at one that was really monumental to me in such a weird way. I had moved to California at a really young age by myself. I was my late 17s and turned 18 really quick. And so I was out here kind of pioneering my dream by myself and, you know, didn't have any really support from anybody besides my friends. But my mom actually did something really cool that at the time I thought was kind of half corny, the things that moms do, and then half fantastic, because once I started ingesting it, it started changing my life. And she gave me this this set of cassettes in this book, and you would, it's a big plastic thing, and you would open it up, and so you'd have a set of cassettes on this side, a set of cassettes on that side. Back in that day, it's the weirdest helicopter sound I've ever heard in my life. It's like a flying train. But these cassettes were a psychologist, and I cannot for the life of me figure out who this guy was in this day and age, but it was some guy that made a just a set of like, I think it was 12 cassettes, I think it was. And it was just a set of cassettes that was about improving your life and living your life better. That's about as wrapped up as it was. And it had all these different subjects in it. It didn't matter. You just threw one in and listened to it. And I was always painting or drawing or doing something else with my time. So I would just put these on while I was, it was mainly painting at the time. And this guy had a ton of information on how to communicate. And, you know, there's all different categories of communicating, right? And there's some categories we don't really think about. And I'll give you the one that I think that most people don't think about is the communicating with yourself. And I have the whole thing on expressing yourself, which is about you making sure that as you ingest the universe and come up with ideas and concepts that you have determined outlets of how you would move that information out of you instead of being a subject to the universe where you're sort of just some flag flying in the wind and you're subject to the wind. You're actually a vessel. You're a flute. You're something that actually has discipline to it that creates a better outward expression of your inner feelings, right? So that was the expressing self thing. But in communicating, you know, a lot of our successes in life, both with ourself, with our family, and our work. If you've seen one of my other essays, it dealt with the fact that I divide life into the self, the family, and the job. And those are the three areas I think that you live in every single day. I don't know. I can't identify a fourth. I came up with this probably in my mid-20s and managed my life based on those three compartments. And since then, I know where I am. Any problem that comes into my life, I just look at it and go, this one affects this one. You know, sometimes they cut across all three of those. Like if you have something happen that's really intense, it can cut across all three categories, but it's going to be in one of those three or more. But no, there's not a fourth one that I know of. But communicating has been the way that in my personal life, I've been able to get the jobs that I've been able to get, because eventually you have to go in for the interview. Your resume only goes so far, and your resume is a form of communication that is based on your perception of yourself, right? If as long as you're writing your resume. And a lot of people that don't have the ability to write resumes, they don't have a conversation with themselves. And that could mean you think thoughts to yourself, or it could mean you speak out loud to yourself. But just to conceive of yourself in a way that I think one of the ways it helps me is to perceive yourself almost in the third person. You're in the room with yourself, and you're sort of observing yourself. And a lot of people get spooked out by that. You know, there's people that think that if the kids sit in their room and talk to themselves and you pretend to be characters or whatever, that the parents like, my kid's going crazy. And it's like, no, your kid's going to be really well balanced when life takes off, because they will have had the conversation with themselves. You almost mentor yourself. And you know that my belief system is that we have another energy that is what we are. It's not a religious thing. I think it's a very scientific thing. I think we're symbiotically these two things. You have your perfect self. You can feel that's part of the universe and part of just a pure, it's not electron energy, but I would say some sort of patternized energy that has our thought patterns in it. It might be an umbilical cord to the universe, the silver cord that the Hindus talk about. But our vessel is very flawed all the time, right? Which is why you can feel what you're supposed to do, but your vessel just can't do it, right? You know, you have chemicals that overflow in our system and make us do the wrong thing. From time to time, you eat the food you're not supposed to eat, you cheat, kiss the girl you're not supposed to kiss, or you cheat on somebody, or, you know, you're doing things you know you're not supposed to do, and it's just a matter of fact. You might steal a piece of candy when you're a kid, and you know it's wrong, but you just gotta have it, because your vessel says take it, right? So, you know, just on the self real quick, and I'm gonna loop back to all these in great detail, but, you know, if you are struggling with a concept in your mind, one of the things that I think you'll find extremely helpful is say out loud, as if you're disciplining yourself, and I don't mean like cussing at yourself or anything, but I mean just pretend like you're your best friend and say out loud the thing that you need to hear someone else say, even though that someone else isn't there. Like I've had myself in situations where, you know, you get into a breakup with a girl And as much as your friends can talk you through things for hours, they need to go to bed and live their life and need to be on your own. And, you know, I found it useful when I was younger to say out loud, I'm going to be okay. But say it in a tone of voice as if I'm somebody else. It's really weird. But when your body hears that, it empirically knows that's true. You know, time heals everything. Time heals all loss. It's this crazy golden mean of consciousness and the universe, right? So there's the self, then there's your family. Obviously, if you don't communicate well within your family, you have a tough hurdle ahead of you. And now within family, we have some constraints and challenges, because a lot of times, especially in today's society where every kid gets a trophy, right? So you go off to the championship and you lose and here's a trophy. So you never really deal with the reality that life is going to impose on you. Life doesn't hand out trophies when you lose, right? So all these parents think they're doing their kids a favor, making them feel like winners when they're actually losers, when they don't have any attention span to get good at anything. They don't have any self-pride in making something with any quality or performing well in whatever they're doing. They're seeding their kids with absolute failure and an absolute inability to deal with life. Once something gets hard, they just shut off the TV and run away. I mean, everything is just sort of like, I can't deal with this, boom. And then normal life becomes this over-amazingly stressful thing, right? So sometimes we have to battle sort of the protocol of today and the way that we communicate with ourselves and break down the communication. So the reason why I mention that is when I talk about family, you'll have usually, if you're an adult and you get married or you have a spouse and you have some children, you'll have to raise your children and you have to make all those decisions for them about how much of reality you want your kid to ingest, how much do they have to learn about failure and death and those heavier concepts. You know, do you keep them out of that for a little while? And, you know, there's always a balance, and I would never try to sway you either way there. I think there is a balance that you can come up with, but it depends on your environment, on your situation. Is your spouse an alcoholic? You know, are you living in the ghetto? Like, I mean, there's all kinds of things you'd have to manage. But the other one is between you and your peer, your spouse. And depending on who you're with, that can be challenging, depending on if you feel like your spouse is engaging reality at a sufficient level to live life. Because a lot of times that will break down when you meet each other. You're super young, you're naive, and even if you're not naive and they're naive, you might make the mistake of saying that they're going to grow up. I've definitely had relationships with individuals when I was, say, 23, they were 21 or 20 or something like that, and they were immature, but I thought, oh, well, you know, this will be a fun journey watching them grow up. Kiss of death, they never did, right? They just became overgrown children. Because they didn't have a machine in their mind to communicate with themselves, to communicate with reality, right? And then, of course, like I said, there's the work one where you build a resume. Hopefully, a resume has great accuracy and relevance to get you the opportunity to interview, to say all the other things that you need to say. A lot of people make their resumes too big, and when they always say a resume should fit on a single page, at least per decade of your life, so if you have a 20-year job, you might go into the second page. But the idea is just to tantalize them. Just give them a little bit of knowledge about you, or enough knowledge about you, I should say, to make them want to sit down in front of you and ask you all those questions. And that's when you can have the hour-long conversation. When I got my job, my first completely full-time job at Electronic Arts, my interview was 9 hours long. I just got cycled through all the department heads and all the employees, and the employees took me to lunch, and because I was going to be their manager, and so they were like, well, if you're going to manage us, you got to be cool. And so we sat down and had lunch and talked about all kinds of stuff and found out where we had a lot of commonality. But before we completely jump off into the specifics about how communication can be used, I just want to sort of give a broad stroke about where I think communicating is today and sort of the fundamental hurdles, especially of Americans. And I sadly think that our westernized American culture has bled over into Europe. And I think that in some areas of Europe, it was necessary for them to get some of our more flamboyant communicating styles, where we say everything that comes to our mind And then I think it was good that Europe, through globalization, I hate to use that word, especially on this show, but, you know, us having the internet to kind of help us, because we're across an ocean, you know, we don't have a lot of communication with Europe, and Europe has this beautiful communication with all the different countries, and so they get to see different languages and see different behaviors and cultures, and so they kind of realize that they're not the only game in town. But in America over here, we're the only game in town, and Canadians are so close to us, it's just a few little inflections on vowels that make us know that they're from another country, right? And of course, Mexico is different. South America is extremely unique to itself, but that's why it's its own little continent down there. But one of the fundamental issues for Americans is that we are raised with this notion of sort of the cowboy mentality, especially if you're, you know, the cliche from Europe to us is that we're all the cowboys, right? And in the Second Amendment gun-toting rights and method, I would say, yes, we're absolutely cowboys. We believe in freedom. We believe in inalienable rights. We don't like tyranny. We don't like cameras on us. We don't like surveillance. That's just us, right? And everyone in Europe and Australia went through the same thing, right? And sadly got convinced to give it all up. But the communication style of a cowboy, sadly today, because back in the 1800s, we had rapport, you know, and it was only these gunslingers that would walk into town and do crazy stuff that was sort of atypical behavior, and that's how they became legends, killing each other, right? For snoring or something, right? But in America, we are taught to say anything that comes in our mind, and it's extremely dangerous. There's very little pause in an American kid, an early adult, and now it's becoming adults, between what you think and just what you say. Boom, boom. It's one and the same. And that's creating a lot of tension, a lot of immaturity, and it's creating a lot of loss in individuals that otherwise would succeed if they just insert a bit of a pause in there and a bit of a thought process in there, and realizing that, and it comes with time. I think every human being gets to a point where they physically get tired because they're older, and that tiredness gives them sort of a buffer, a genetic buffer between talking and thinking, because they have this thought and they're like, wow, do I even breathe into my lungs enough energy to say anything at all? And in that little contemplation period of physical anomaly, they actually have additional thoughts to say, I don't need to say that. I don't need to say anything. Or I'll just say something nice, you know? So that's one of the defects in America. And, you know, one of the defense mechanisms that Americans have about that communication style is that we're very genuine. You know, we keep it real, as they say, right? So we're always saying everything, and then we kind of have to say all these apologies because we've been offensive, or we even said things we don't believe ourselves. Like I've said several times in other shows, you know, if you're going to go off and have a very difficult conversation with someone, or have a presentation, but mostly the difficult conversation with any human being on earth or group of people, you want to practice by yourself. Say it out loud. Drive in your car and talk to yourself. Hell, everyone thinks you're talking to your phone now anyway. Pace your living room if you got the chance to do it without someone listening to you. Give yourself 100% privacy so you don't have any inhibitions about saying everything on your mind. And one magical thing will occur is that you will hear yourself say things that you don't believe. And it's a real interesting thing. It goes back to that sort of spirit, you know, vessel relationship, where your vessel will say it, but then you feel your inner self, your inner core being, wherever that is, basically disagree with you. And that is a very educational process, and it will help you refine what you think. And, you know, if you have the experience like me, you'll say something that you totally don't believe, but it just needed to come out of you. Like, you needed to get the broken thought out of your mind, the discombobulated, scattered, chaotic interpretation of something out of your system. And you realize, man, that didn't even make any sense. Or I'm way off the beaten path, or I'm getting emotional when I should be very professional. And it eventually that becomes second nature to you. You will start to learn again who you are by communicating out loud what you think you believe. It's interesting. And, you know, you do have to police the indoctrination that would make you pander. You know, like the whole thought police thing, which I didn't really touch on, was that there's this pandering envelope to make people feel better about themselves. And I think that pandering is very dangerous, because pandering is, you know, it's a bit like that old adage where you can't bring yourself up by putting someone else down, right? So someone, like when you were a kid, it was always the put down thing in the 80s. You would make fun of kids on the playground. Most of the time they're making fun of me, but when you slip into it, I've done it many times, and you feel your soul go down. You know, you just feel like I'm a jerk for having said it. Even if you're correct, even if you're right about whatever the hell you're saying, you still feel like you shouldn't have said it, and it's dumb. It's almost like this sort of moral force from the universe that kind of lets you know you're being negative and you should stop. But pandering has the same exact effect for me personally. I don't know about you, but anytime you pander, you feel like a piece of shit. You just feel like, why am I making people feel good about things that I don't feel good about? Why am I lying that I like something I don't like? And I don't know when I got into it. I don't know when I got out of it. But I do know by the time I was in my early 30s, I had sort of just said, I'm not going to pander anymore. My heroes don't pander. You know, and there was a couple guys, John Lennon was extremely famous for this, and I know there's millions of people before him, I just don't know exactly who they are. Jack Welch used to run General Electric, wrote a book, and he has a chapter on being candid, and he says, just be honest, for God's sakes. You don't have to be rude, but you just need to be honest. And I find that when you adopt pandering as a mechanism to live your life and make other people feel better, you tend to allow in your circle a bunch of people that you really have nothing in common with, because you constantly pander to make them feel like you have something in common with them when you have nothing in common with them or very little in common with them. I think that pandering people also tend to pretend to like everything in the universe. You can play the most horrible music and they'll pander and say they like it because they're afraid that someone in the room is going to be upset. So what do you do in its place? How do you stop pandering? And I would say that if you're uncertain about how to behave when something happens, you go for silence first. The second one is tough because you'll have people that play on panderism. You know, they play on the idea that I can force you to like something. I have a couple friends of mine who will do various things in the world where they're performing, and they'll videotape themselves, so they'll make a little short. And before I've had a chance to see what they've done, and I'm usually helping them in their careers, trying to figure out what's the next step or what's the next improvement that's important, they would feed me full of all this, you know, you're going to love it, you're going to love it, oh, it's the best thing, it's everybody loves it, and da-da-da-da-da, just giving me all these accolades before I've had a chance to see it and have my own opinion. And then invariably, just like that horrible movie trailer where they're giving you all the movie quotes from newspapers, anytime you see a trailer with a bunch of movie quotes in the trailer before you've seen the film, that film is a complete bomb, and they know it. And so they're trying to validate it by a bunch of people that you don't know. And of course, it's always quoted from some horrible source. But every time I watch, typically something that's been really pumped up like that, it never pans out. One, they got my expectations really high anyway, at least they used to, and now my expectations actually go down. And more often than not, even when I take my expectations down on something that's been really pumped up, it's even worse than I ever imagined. But on the upshot of not getting into pandering, I'll tell you this much. I've said many times on the show, and I hate to say this because I really dislike the name-dropping thing, and I'm not going to drop any names, but I've been very privileged to work with the heroes of my past. And, you know, the one name I've dropped was Steve Jobs, and I had this weird email relationship with him, which turned into a bunch of things. And there's a bunch of those type of guys at that level that I've had this privilege of working with. And I'll say this much. The best relationships I have on planet Earth are because I didn't pander when they gave me their films and said, hey, here's a film I just wrote. Tell me what you think. And I'm looking at a guy who wrote movies that I absolutely love. And so I read the script and I'm like, you know, I don't really like this third act at all. I don't like this scene at all. It was too slow here or whatever. But I got to figure out a way to be tactful and constructive about how to say I didn't like it. And in one case, I was able to get a third act completely rewritten by the writer, and he eventually, about a year later, after we moved it into optioning and stuff like that in Hollywood, he looked at me once in his living room and he goes, you know, I wouldn't have gotten that third act that I like way better had you not ribbed me about how bad it was. And at that point, it was like one of the best compliments I've ever had in my entire life. But I only gained that because I wasn't artificial and I didn't pander. And what I'm trying to get at is something that is known by all, but it's practiced by few, and it's not consciously understood by many. And you may disagree with me, but I think that the next word I'm going to use is the one missing quality of a lot of communication backbones. Like, your foundation of how you communicate is best suited by trying to be as genuine as possible. Pandering is the opposite of being genuine, right? Now, it takes a lot of work sometimes to remain genuine and not hurt people's feelings, especially those tender people out there that no matter how old they are, they're walking around just waiting to be offended, like I always say. My advice to you is to politely dismiss them out of your life on a long-term basis, because it will waste your time. If you have to spend more than 60 seconds thinking about how to say something to someone that is especially like optional stuff, you know, they played an album for you and it was just awful, and they want you to love it and you don't like it at all. You know, you might go through the exercise of listening to it two or three more times and figure out if there's something you're missing. But some people, again, pander so much in their life that they claim to like everything. And I think that that's super dangerous. That's why all the crappy stuff occurs in the world. That's why computer software gets bad, computers get bad, cars get bad, music gets horrible, because they're buying trash constantly because they don't want to offend anybody, right? But I was touching on one on the subject of being genuine. I touched briefly, and I didn't really explain it in enough detail. Like, I heard the story with the Hindu philosophy of creating communication with each other. And I had this explained to me by someone who studied a bunch of gurus, not by a guru personally, but he did a beautiful job saying that the Hindus that he had studied from had said that every form of expression that we create is a sort of a ball of energy in our, say, our chest. And it goes up and out and delivers to the other person. And to the degree that you're genuine and honest and true, they will find value in what you say. And so when we have acidic thoughts, negative thoughts, or disingenuous thoughts, it will actually come out and register in the other person 100% subconsciously. Sort of like, again, my subconscious definition is really the spirit. So, you know, not a religious thing, but your inner being understands the intent of any phrase that's actually said. Whether or not your conscious lobes, your left and right lobes, that you're using to create this vessel, understand, you do get it deep down inside. So, it's very important that, let's just say, if you had a video camera on you constantly, you wouldn't do certain things by yourself that you do without a video camera on you. Now, I hate that analogy because I hate surveillance, and I think it's a repugnant way for societies to behave and you know, monitor each other. We should just be good and not need that type of surveillance. But anyway, the feeling of it coming out and attaching to you is that a magic when you're together. You know, like, you're watching me through a YouTube video. You have no magic of my being, and I have no magic of your being, of you sitting exactly where the camera is and us feeling each other's presence. There's a beautiful, almost like, I almost call it like emotional candy or spiritual candy. It's almost sexual on some levels, you know, where you have this deep connection with someone who's super duper cool. And I say sexual just because it goes beyond the like and love realm. There's something physical that's attracting between just being with any human being. And it has nothing to do with physical interaction on a sexual level, but it's just, there's a beautiful connection. So when you're in that realm communicating, you must live in your most genuine capacity, in my opinion. You feel me? Consequently, I do think that the scam artists of the world are able to take something that is nefarious, some sort of scam, put it inside of a wrapper that makes it feel good, makes it feel genuine, right? And they deliver that, this car is great, this TV is going to have the best picture, anything else that they're trying to sell you at your doorstep, and you take it in and you get burned, right? And then what happens is It's just my hunch is that when you feel that person's outer wrapper from somebody else, they have the same voice, the same delivery, the same tone, the same vocabulary, you start to be suspicious of good people because that smells like the pattern that you took in when you got scammed last time. And that's why people that run scams are, they have to be purged from society because they are messing it up for the rest of us, right? You know, there's a lot of phrases and a lot of catchphrases about, you know, the girl or the guy that cheats on the other person, and they create this distrust, this fundamental distrust in a relationship, which, again, it goes back to that whole thing about how you shouldn't sleep around before you get married because you might get burned. And when you get burned, you'll have a hard time fully committing to the person that you actually find that is your soulmate, for whatever, for lack of a better term, right? And, you know, you won't find me holding up any banner signs for not having sex before marriage, but you know what I'm talking about. Just try to keep your numbers down, I think, is probably the best piece of advice, at least before you try it and give it your all. So I'm going to go at... I've been talking a lot about the self and the family. I'm going to run off and do one about work, professionalism. And then we're going to loop back to the minutiae of interpersonal communications, because I think we need a break from the foundational pieces here. One of the reasons why I wanted to do this particular deep thoughts has to do with when I was an executive at various companies in my lifetime, especially when I ran my own company. We always talk about how empathy is dying in the world. And a lot of people go, yeah, whatever. I'm totally empathetic. So empathy can help form the bonds and the weaves in society such that we communicate better with each other and act out better because we know what someone else is feeling. But if you take it away from the homeless sign, right, the guy trying to collect money at your latest, you know, your nearest intersection, and take it into a professional realm, there's something that I learned... before I made the mistake, someone actually briefed me on how to do this correctly. And it had to do with something called the executive summary. And I talk about this because I'm going to pull the executive summary lesson back into your personal life because it's very important that you understand empathetically how to communicate with people. So I used to run departments. My first department was two guys, and then, you know, my biggest department was probably 55 people, and I was actually running two other departments, which total up about 80 people or so. And when you manage that many people, you have a challenge on your hand to know what the left and right hand are doing, left and right foot are doing, and all that stuff. And so there has to be a communication protocol because you can't ask 80 people what they're doing. But somehow you need to know what 80 people are doing, not in a control freaky way, but just to kind of get the average gestalt of what your department's doing. You know, what is, are we good? Is there any hot spots? You know, are we ahead anywhere? Should I be, you know, voting for, you know, awards for people because they did great jobs, all that kind of stuff. And what we came up with was something called the executive summary email. And essentially, and you'll find a lot of people that have said this, I'm not the inventor of this by any stretch, but this is what absolutely transformed my life, both in my professional and my personal life. And I didn't get it into my personal life until I learned it on my professional, which is why I'm organizing it like this for you guys. But at one point I had four different managers managing everybody underneath. And what we came up with was the executive summary, which was a bullet list of what was going on in your department. Basically, the hot spots need to go first, things we need to act on right away, and then give me some good news, basically. Give me bad news first, good news second, and keep it short. Keep it in little tiny sentence bursts. I don't want anything over half a page when I'm in executive summary mode. And, you know, I was completely lucky that everyone that I either inherited as managers or hired into the organization were unbelievable communicators. So I have had one of the most privileged lives when I was working for other people in this particular territory. But then when I formed my own company, I had three different partners, and two were tech guys, and one was our essentially business manager. And so she was an attorney, so she knew exactly how to do executive summary stuff super duper fast. So I had one tech guy who was already acclimated to me because he worked for me at Electronic Arts, so he totally understood the executive summary thing. And he was an extremely verbose individual to begin with. So if I got him on the telephone, I'd have to pry him off the phone because he wanted to talk my ear off. But if he sent me an email, he knew how to do it. But my other guy, who's a super dude, awesome guy, he felt obligated to make sure I understood all the minutiae of everything. And so I completely forgot to pass on the executive summary lesson before we started communicating. So it was of no fault of his own. He was just really trying to do a great job, and he did an amazing job. But his emails would run 3 to 10 pages, and it got to a point where I had to say, look, and he would send like 4 or 5 of these things a day, you know? And I thought, well, part of me is going, well, geez, do you get any work done? Because this stuff takes a long time. And I don't care if you type 120 words per minute, it takes a while to figure out what to say here. And it's also consuming my time because I don't know if the most important thing in there is like on page 3. And so we started having our company meetings, and I started, you know, giving this advice. And it took a while to pound it out of him to get him to stop doing it because he still found this core value in over-communicating. So there's a long way to say there's something called executive summary, and it has to do with what information is necessary right now because time is money and time is life. Now, in a business sense, time is money. We need to complete as many steps as possible to get to our next milestone, to get our next release product, to get to our next paycheck, the next, you know, project. In your personal world, you have a little bit more freedom, of course, and you can make your life however you want. If you have 2 super communicators and you guys just like talking for hours and hours and hours, this does not apply to you whatsoever. But I live my personal life very much like I live my business life, and because I'm into so many different things, I have so many projects going at once that I have to actually police and manage my life. Because if I don't, a 3-hour conversation with someone could be a milestone in some other project. That then the rewards would benefit the both of us being together, sort of thing, right? What's funny is what I found in my lifetime is that no one wants to support your projects in your family life. And, you know, depending on, I mean, I've had a couple of people do it, but a lot of times they're so self-involved no matter what. And it's not necessarily a slight, it's just how they're raised, that they don't want to necessarily support your time off to get your projects finished. But the second your project gets finished, you get an accolade, some money, some notoriety, there's a couple VIP events or something like that. Well, they want to be frontline, front and center. They want the reward system out of what you're doing, but they don't want to support you while you're getting it. And I've run into that a lot in my lifetime. So why you have to purge people out of your life that aren't in tune with what your needs are. But I'll give you an example of when I was young, I would go visit my family in Kansas from California. And I would go visit my grandmothers. And one of my grandmothers was very progressive. And she had lived a lot of life. And she had been her own woman. She had been a teacher for 36 years and done a bunch of other stuff in her lifetime. And just was really into this human condition. And my other grandmother, super sweet. Both these women are my heroes in life, and for a lot of my upbringing were my mother's, you know. But my other grandmother was sort of a homebody, and she'd raised 5 kids beautifully. She did an amazing job. But she hadn't really ventured out in the world. She hadn't traveled very many of the states in the United States, had never been to Europe. And you could tell that in her life, when I would talk to her, I would get, you know, 15-minute dissertations about how the laundry went today. You know, and how, you know, I forgot a receipt and I had to go down to the fact of all this little minutiae and stuff that gave me dimension of who she was as a human being, but really didn't get to a communication level. It was more like a presentation, like an exhibitional conversation between the two of us. And, you know, I sat and listened to it because I love my grandmother to death, and just, those are my fond memories of her nowadays. But I also wasn't married to my grandmother. I didn't have to, you know, do this, but you know, 10 days out of the year, so it was very tolerable at those levels. In my personal life, I'll find that some people will over communicate the most minutia crap. Right, they'll go off to visit random friends that I have no idea who they are, and I'll get like the most detailed stories about names and places that will add no value to the conversation whatsoever, have absolutely no interest points at all. And it's almost like listening to a story that is pitched as a really amazing story, but there's no end and there's no crescendo and there's no nothing. You're just sitting there listening. I used to have a friend of mine that would say, "Oh my God, I got to tell you this." And you're like, "Ooh, wow. Okay, tell me something cool." And he just meander. It had no conclusion, no point in the story, plotless, anti-plot conversation, right? And so he was missing out on why people didn't want to hang out with the guy. So now let's reel back in. That was just a little foundational thing. So communicating is at the very core of being human, right? If you don't communicate with others at all, your insides will get tense because you have things to say. And in fact, the more that it's really funny, the people that think they're super duper smart used to turn into hermits. And part of it was because they became socially incompatible with society, so nothing they could say was of any interest to anyone around them. And thank God we have the internet, so we can have this conversation right now. But the idea is that that person who's up there being a hermit will get bitter and weird because they resent society because it isn't compatible with them. And so you absolutely have to find some beautiful, basic level of communication that's good for everybody, you know? Everyone tends to fall in love. Everyone tends to fall in like, you know? There's things that you disagree about. How many times have you ever watched a movie and you both didn't like it and you came out and you just had this great conversation, how much better it could be if they did this, this, and this? Or you love the film and you come out and you're like, "Oh my God, remember that scene? Oh, I love that scene." Those are rich moments in life, right? But when I had those tapes, when I was a kid, one of the things that this guy said on the tape, and again, I was like 18 years old listening to these things, so I was flawed to the nines with my communication style, was that he said this little analogy. This is sort of like, it's a non sequitur, that's what I want to say to what I'm saying. But he said that, have you ever been at a party? And you've heard a bunch of people grouped in little cliques here and there as they kind of, you know, mosey around the party. And someone's talking about something you know a lot about. And in your perception, in your mind, they're completely wrong about everything they're talking about. You know, there's a million topics we could throw in the conversation today. But you're young and you're just hearing about something, whether it be music trivia, movie trivia, acting trivia, whatever it is, something foo-foo. And you feel the need to push yourself. You walk to that crowd and you push yourself in that circle, and then you say, this is his analogy, he said, you know, you inject yourself in the conversation. You make sure that you tell everyone who's not talking that the person that was talking is completely wrong, and then you set the record straight. And that's a very, you know, acute version of the problem that I don't think a lot of people quite do it that dramatically. But he said, you can't do that. Once you do that, everyone's going to think you're a dick and you're not going to be invited to the parties anymore. Anytime you walk to the crowd, they're going to shut up and turn around and diffuse the crowd because they don't want to listen to you talk. And when I heard that, I was like, wow, that is something that I do at the time. You know, it wasn't that dramatic. I would never be rude like that, but I definitely had my version of that. And I think that happens in society constantly. And I think it happens at home. I think it happens at work. So that's one little tidbit about communication I wanted to kind of throw at you to kind of watch how we behave, right? Now, the other one I find real interesting is that, and this is one of the unspoken truths about communicating, which is, this is the stuff that makes me really excited to talk about it, which is we come from all walks of life. And the older that you are, the more that these walks of life are completely different. Why mention that? Because it completely and utterly controls what someone is likely to want to hear and likely to want to talk about. I'll give an example. I am from technically the Midwest, and I moved to California. You guys heard me say that a billion times. I have met people in my lifetime that are from one town. They've lived there their whole life. They've had very basic, beautiful lives. I mean, absolutely the most privileged kids on earth, right? They've had, their parents are still married. They have maybe one job their entire life, just beautiful. And I envy that, you know, on a lot of levels, because they have that power structure of all their friends that grew up and became something. They can actually network with those people to create businesses and generally have a great time, move around this town and go to really cool events because everyone has a ticket to something. You know, it's really neat. And I didn't have that kind of upbringing. My background is I've lived in over 23 homes in my lifetime, probably more than that, but sometimes I moved to two places in one town. I went to 7 different schools before I graduated high school, several different colleges after that. I don't have a degree. I've had at least 8 major jobs in my lifetime. Like in my realm, it would be multiple year jobs, creating lots of heavy products and really famous stuff with these companies and other great minds that work together. And so what I've realized is that what is interesting to me is based on my upbringing and based on my life story. When I realized having conversations with individuals that have lived fairly, I don't want to say shelter lives by any stretch of the imagination, because that's a very relative sense, but when they've lived a very focused life, and the problems that I ran into moving around the world and having to meet new people constantly and having to take on new disciplines constantly and changing my career. I mean, my career has gone through so many different professions that have absolutely nothing to do with each other. It's hard for me to describe it to you. But for someone who's able to stay in one discipline their whole life, you know, I've met a guy once that worked at the Budweiser factory for up here in Van Nuys area for 40 years. You know, he went in as a kid and he retired out as a guy in his late 50s. His perception of the world is entirely different than mine, having moved to major cities and different areas, different, you know, all kinds of different elements. And it's not to say he's naive or anything like that. He could have gone to war before he went to work for Budweiser and seen things that I've never seen. I'm sure everyone's seen something that someone else hasn't seen. Everyone's experienced that kind of stuff. But what I found out in my later years is that the style of communication is largely based on your experience in life. And unfortunately, there's no protocol for us to sit down with another human being early in a friendship or relationship and say, all right, you need to know who I am. And I've had this life experience, and this is what's important to me. And this is what's absolutely not important to me. My priorities are on every second matters in life. Life isn't a rehearsal. I'm not here to do the same thing 50 times in life. I want to do 50 different things as opposed to 50 things that are exactly the same. Whatever the formula is between you and someone else. And that's why I think that people that grow up in the same town and end up getting married or having a relationship have an incredible advantage over two random people who find it interesting to be together because they came from completely different walks of life. And I've heard both. I've heard both work amazingly. I got a friend of mine whose parents have been married since they got married back in the day in the late 60s, and they're together to this day, and the woman's from Scotland and the father's from California. And you couldn't have been further away. They met in their 20s due to him serving in the military, and they are the most ultimate couple on earth. And so it doesn't mean that there's any hard, fast rules about being compatible or not being compatible, but I'll tell you, when you get into a professional communication, and I'm probably preaching to the choir, I understand, but when you get into a professional capacity and you start sniffing each other's butts in the conversation where you're like, well, what have you done? What have you done? You know, very quickly, when you start sharing your background and the extent of your participation in reality, and someone's like I, by the time I was in my early 20s, I'd done quite a bit of stuff in software and help invent products that are pretty famous these days. And when I was probably 23, 24, and I had a guy who was, you know, 15 years older than me, who was this big hotshot salesman at my company at the time, sort of just asked me what I've done. It looked like I just came out of college because I was really scrawny and covered with pimples. And when I said what I had done in the multiple careers, I probably had 3 or 4 drastically different careers by the age of 23. This guy had actually sold Lucchese leather boots for 20 years of his life before he became this software sales guy. So he thought, you know, well, I've sold $3,000, you know, boots in my lifetime to vendors, and I've traveled the whole world, and I've, you know, done whatever he's done. And then when he really came down to it, you know, meeting the pavement, you know, his the substance of what he had done, he realized that it doesn't matter how old you are. It really matters on what you've actually done. You know, and I wasn't better than him, and he wasn't better than me or anything like that. It's not what I'm trying to say. It's just that when he learned that I'd had a pretty detailed walk of life and that I'd been participating at the really high levels of these companies at a really, really young age, he had respect for me. And I already had respect for him because he was my elder, you know, and he was a great guy, great communicator, and he taught me quite a bit. In fact, I was wearing Lucchese boots when we had the conversation, which was really weird. And it turns out that I had saved about $2,300 on my boots because I did not pay $3,000 for my pair. And he goes, just before I came to this company, he goes, I sold those boots for $2,500. I was like, damn, I only bought them for $700. He goes, they're $3,000 now. It's crazy. They're not worth that. They're really nice. But the other one is, you know, the communication style that would get you out of your shell. A lot of people are extremely shy because, again, it starts out with being shy, starts out with not knowing who you are. When you don't know who you are, you're afraid to experiment your very first try out there with other people. And I'll give you an analogy in music. For any of you who've ever tried to learn an instrument, I don't care what it is, you typically will fail to practice because other people can hear you play that instrument badly, and you do not want to be bling, ding, ding, you know, on a guitar or flubbing on the piano or whatever it is you're trying to do. If you play even more complex instruments like brass or woodwind or something, you have reeds in your mouth that you're trying to resonate properly. You know what to push on the neck, but you don't know how to make it the air come out of your body properly. Okay. Communication is exactly the same way. When you don't know who you are, man, you just start to clam up, and that becomes a guaranteed failure. There is no one who has remained shy who has succeeded in life as completely shy all the way to the end. What was it, that Beach Boy guy that wrote most of their music? He got so recluse. I think it's still an issue for him today. I forgot his name, but he's the guy that locked himself up in his house and got crazy. Look at Howard Hughes, which I think he's probably poisoned. But I mean, he got crazy and locked himself up and saved his pee and his fingernails and all this other weird crap. If you're shy, we got to break through it. We got to get through that. And it could be that you communicate, but you know, on average, you're shy. And you could have a process where you're shy at first, which could actually be mistaken for, well, it could be, shyness can be mistaken for being guarded. You could just simply be guarded until you realize what you should say. And this is kind of how I am. When I'm with the new crowd, I don't try to rush in because I can talk anyone's ear off, as you know. So I never try to talk like this in public unless someone is just, you know, enamored with some subject that I might have some information on, or they're really finding it rewarding to have the back and forth. Of course, for me, believe it or not, you know, I'm not one of these guys that likes the sound of my voice. I truly hate it, honestly. And when I like to teach and have the students look at me and have epiphanies. I love that process. But in the end, I want to hear other people talk to me about stuff I'm interested in, which is why I've remained genuine and not pandered to my closest friends. My closest friends will bust my balls. I mean, it's tremendous how they'll you know, point at me and go, "You're an asshole." You know, and they don't mean I'm an asshole as a complete being. They're just saying whatever you just said makes you an asshole. And then we debate. And we don't get angry, and we keep walking down the street, and we go to dinner, and we go to lunch, or whatever, and we shake hands and say, can't wait to see you again at the end of the conversation. But that's what grownups can do once they stop being disingenuous and pandering and being PC, right? There's no political correctness between my friends and I at all, right? And we'll have heated debates. It's great. So back on the communication side, very specifically, the goal is to find a way that you can say what you need to say beautifully. That might sound ridiculously simple, but think about it. You need to say what you need to say beautifully. What that will do is it will allow people to listen to you and make them want to listen to you. and give you the chance to express your opinion, the more articulate that you are. Now, I said in the last deep thoughts, what do we call these things, that poetry is a big deal when I talked about expressing yourself. Poetry is huge because it teaches you how to write your own language or whatever language you want to write it in. It teaches you how to express yourself. And at first, your poetry paragraphs are huge. And in the end, you end up being able to say your line with as few words as possible with a maximum impact on what you're trying to say. For those of you who've seen my screenwriting episode, that is the goal of a screenwriter, is to write the fewest amount of words to say the most within that realm. And not to use words that are so sort of celebratory of how many syllables you can say, like celebratory, right? You don't want to say things that don't trip off the tongue beautifully, right? That don't flow. There's got to be a cadence and a beauty to it, you know? Most of you have probably heard that if you want to write a story and you want to create an action scene, for instance, you would use smaller words because you want the brain to go up, duh, 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 and you want the brain to increase the beat of how fast it can take in these words. And again, you want to use the fewest amount of words at that point and the smallest length of word, less syllables. If you can do it all with single syllable words, man, you've won. If you can make people go poof in their chest while they're reading your script, boom, you got them. You can also use that in the inverse to slow things down. But as you form emails, which is a huge part of the communication nowadays, where you don't have any more tone, you're not really there to express the words. You need to be very careful. And I know that everyone listening to me, if you've sent even 1,000 emails in your lifetime, you've sent off one of those doozies where your friend or your loved one calls you up and says, what the fuck, dude? You know, that was totally offensive, man. And you're like, well, adults don't get offended. But anyway, you're not there to deliver it. So you have to be very careful how you formulate your phrases, right? So the other one I want to talk about, let's say you completely understand, and I'm sure you do, everything I just said. Again, this could be just comparing notes and me affirming what you already think. Maybe there's a couple nuggets in there you hadn't thought of before. But there's a big extra dimension on communication that I think is, again, at least in America, it's completely lost. And I don't mean to bash my own country, for God's sakes, but I think that, you know, to say that we're perfect and we don't have to learn any other communication styles would be atrocious. But early 90s, I actually got involved with a company that was headquartered in Sussex, England. And they would fly their people over to talk to us, and we would work on software together. And I remember the first time I ever had one of these meetings, I couldn't hear the person right in front of me. This British guy, and he would talk so quiet, it was unbelievable. I couldn't understand what he was saying, and it was almost to the point of, like, I was angry that communication style was so absurdly conservative. And I was, you know, for me, I was like, look, there's no way anybody could just hear what you're saying. Forget the words that you're choosing and what you're trying to communicate. My thought was, you're trying to make this difficult so that I, the American, have to grovel down to you to figure out what the hell you're saying. I must ask you to clarify what you're saying. And I remember being in the conversation. It was sort of a higher-up guy, and I was a higher-up guy on this side, even though I was really young. And I think that was the big deal, because the class structure in England is that young people are stupid and old people are smart. And I was one of the brainiacs in the company, so I thought, you know, I'm not gonna put up with this shit more than a couple times, right? I'm going to ask this guy to raise his voice if he doesn't stop. And sure enough, the guy kept with this low volume thing, and I have bionic hearing. I can hear shit that nobody hears, man. I can hear, you know, 2 blocks away if someone's dryer squeaking, you know, and I'll go, guys, do you guys hear that? And they'll go, no. And we go driving out for dinner, and I park right in front of their house, and I go, that's the asshole with the screwed up dryer. And they go, oh my God, how'd you hear that? So I got no problem hearing people. But I asked this guy, I said, I'm sorry, you know, I didn't hear you. And then the asshole started trying to talk quieter. And so I just said, I'm afraid you're going to have to speak up. I understand what you're saying. I need you to speak up because I'm sitting 1 foot from you and I can't hear what you're saying. So we're going to have to bring up the volume here if we're going to continue communicating. Otherwise, I got to go back to my office. I fucking laid it on the line for that guy, and I embarrassed the shit out of him, which is what British people fucking hate. And it was a touche of like, you want to be an asshole across the table in this communication style to make it a little difficult for us. I'm not sure why he was doing it. I can only imagine. No one else was doing this. The CEO was talking. I could totally hear him. No problem. But eventually, boom, it cranked up and we had a decent conversation. And then I had respect from that guy because I stopped groveling to him. And you'll find that most dominating personalities in the world, they absolutely appreciate someone who is just like them. Because when you ascend through a company, and I'm just going to give you the CEO crash course that that I've encountered myself. I never incorporated this into my being. But you'll find that when you move up in the ranks, those pandering hangers-on, right? The people that just want to eat from your crumbs, they don't really want to participate. They'll do anything that you say, sort of, but they won't really think for themselves. The CEOs get to the point where they see the sheep and they see themselves. And they hear that whole 1% argument about how they have more money than the sheep down below. And they think to themselves, well, it's because you're sheep. It's because you pander to each other. It's because you buy into political correctness. You buy into indoctrination. You buy into all these paradigms that aren't real. You won't think for yourself. So you get exactly what you deserve, which is to be in that poverty-stricken 99%. The key is to be respectful, be fair, don't be flippant or anything, but the key is to throw as much heat back to the CEO as they throw out, or to essentially communicate in the realm, the empathetic realm of their world, what's important to them, right? When I communicated with Steve Jobs as a young man, I was putting myself up in his realm and saying, well, if I lived in your circle, which is a totally different priority set from my circle, these are the things that would be important to me. And that's how I established the friendship. That's how I got communication going back and forth between us. And to the last year of his life, he was still helping me out. So that's a trick. It's lonely at the top. And the executive assistants that I've seen that have moved up through the ranks of being like a call director way down at the bottom, and then they become assistants to the CEO, it's because when the CEO came around and said, how you doing? They were very frank with them, very candid with them. And if anything was bullshit, they called it right to the CEO. And the CEO would laugh and smile. And sometimes they get, if it's opposite sex, they get physically attracted to the person. It's really interesting. But you'll find that the executive assistants for good people, right, that are at the very tippy top, they're typically tough cookies. Male, female, doesn't matter. They're tough cookies. Now, you do have that crazy narcissistic CEO that is looking for minions. They're looking for that sort of false worship, and you'll get these total pandering jerk-offs at the top too, which are, they're essentially so controlled that they have really no function but a ceremonial pick up the phone and answer things, but they're not allowed to control anything in their own life. But a CEO wants a true assistant that helps them out. They want someone who's a duplicate of them. That's all that they want. It's the only reason why anyone hires anyone, is to be a duplicate of themselves, right? So I know this is sort of a cloud of communication concepts, but I'm trying to bring to you the ones that I have seen ruin people's lives and the ones that I am constantly trying to correct in my own life when I'm communicating with individuals. But to get back on the invisible one I was talking about, the invisible attribute of communication that's huge, before I got off into the British guy, was that the tone of our voice and the volume of our voice is paramount to the meaning of what you're saying. I've said a couple times in the past that I made a conscious choice in my mid-teens to be soft-spoken. And I don't really know why, because I don't think anyone around me was quite loud and boisterous. I had a cousin who was hard of hearing, and she was extremely loud. I guess she probably is to this day, but if you have friends that are really, really loud, they typically have lost part of their hearing somehow, genetically or through just going to loud concerts or something. So they'll tend to be really loud. And in their mind, they're completely normal. But in their head, they need to speak louder to hear their own voice. You know, it's weird. What you'll find is that the tone of voice that you choose for yourself tends to dictate your personality. Because obviously, at my tone of voice, I'm just going to say I try to be smooth, because I think that, I'll give you a really weird analogy. The movies that we see where you have like a hitman, like a John Wick, I love this film. He's poetry in motion. You know, his whole thing of how he was killing everybody in the film was that he ties, you know, he has to murder 12 guys in his house at one point, I think, something like that, six, whatever. And he flows through his home. He uses the architecture of his home and the techniques that he uses to kill people all in this beautiful realm where he's got a limited amount of ammunition. He's got to dodge. He's got to fight some guys hand to hand, all this other stuff. So he has this beautiful poetry to his being. And that's a physical analogy of, I think, exactly what you can do with your voice and your communication style. I talked about the guy that, his name is Bob, who was sort of a visual mentor for me. Like, I just watched the guy, and he was just smooth. He's a good-looking cat anyway, and he always dressed really tight. But his style of communication, his really deep voice that he already genetically had, and then he smokes cigarettes, which made it drop even further. But he just had this smoothness. He still has it to this day, but that was the part that I took away from him and said, look, man, I couldn't think anything better about a guy's communication style than this dude, so I'm going to copy it, right? But the people that are really yelly and screamy and shouty, for me personally, that shows a total lack of discipline in yourself, that you have never made the choice of how you want to communicate. You simply took your childhood and that, again, it's usually in America, but that really boisterous, loud, screaming style, and you may think it's funny. A lot of times people say, well, you know, my whole family's loud. I've heard that my whole life, you know, from people. My whole family's loud, and they like to scream and yell. And part of me just, honestly, to not pander to it, I get revolted by it. I get revolted by the fact that we can't be adults and calm down and make a choice and realize empathetically that shouting someone, you know, this far away is unnecessary. So I want to encourage you to think about the tone and the texture and the quality of your voice as you communicate. You might be able to get away with crap at home, yelling and screaming, but when you go to work and you try to get a job and you try to communicate, I guarantee you, your ability to get an executive level position, which is what you want, right, is intangible at that point. You can't get it, because you are obnoxious as a human being to listen to talk, you know. You won't find a lot of celebrities that actually get a lot of camera time unless they're really good speakers, right? They won't get on these talk shows at night, the Jimmy Fallon show or something like that, unless they learn how to communicate really well. Consequently, you know, rappers are very interesting. The old school rappers, as I said, I've had a chance, and here comes a name drop, but I've had a chance to work with LL Cool J in my lifetime at a very intimate level, creating a music studio for him, software that you could do it online sort of thing. And he's been rated as having one of the highest vocabularies in all rap, which is interesting because he's a classic rapper that actually outpaced some of these more modern rappers that use tremendous amounts of words in one rap. But when I would communicate with him, it was phenomenal how smooth this brother is, right? I mean, he always talks about his voice is he's exact like Rack and Pinion in a Jag. I love that line. And he's right. He's right. He's smooth as it can be, super articulate, massively brilliant human being. People who think that rap would leave you sort of, mid-range intelligence, man, this guy is utterly brilliant. Scientifically brilliant too, and it's all on his own. Like, you know, he researches this stuff, and his memory's huge. Of course, if he memorizes all of his albums, he's got a memory that's absolutely crazy. But that's another example of people that succeed that are really smooth, and you want to be that person. I don't give a crap what you tell yourself. If you think it's going to be too much effort to change, it's interesting. But now the tribalism backlash to that, the blowback to being soft-spoken, is that people will misjudge you completely. Now, I could be crazy and yelly and screamy and stuff, but I choose to make that a feature of a particular evening or event or afternoon as opposed to making it my everyday mean of existence. I had an uncle that, I have an uncle, still alive, but when he was younger, before I was even old enough to really know him, he was a crazy greaser, motorcycle guy back in the 50s, super handsome dude. And But he, by the time he became a doctor, he sort of, you know, chilled out, and he got into the whole 60s. He was sort of in that shark suit era, you know, the kind of beatniky kind of area, but he was really that kind of almost rat pack looking guy. And so everyone knew him as very conservative. And one day, I guess my parents were out with him, his brother, my dad. They were out eating dinner, and two cars were parked next to each other. And one was my uncle's Lincoln's. He loved Lincoln's still to this day. But someone had parked a car so close to his car that he couldn't get in the driver's seat. So he had to go through the passenger door, and even that was tight. But he got so angry at the situation that he actually hopped up on the car of the car next to his and just pounced the car with his leather heels and just dented the hood, dented the top, dented the back. And the whole time he's had a little bit to drink, but he never got drunk. But he just was saying, how dare this guy park this piece of crap next to my Lincoln, right? Obviously, that's a crime, but the idea was this. My father was weeping in tears at how funny that situation was, and he was weeping in tears because his brother had kind of chilled out over his life, right? He was in his late 30s, early 40s when he did this, and my dad was 12 years younger than, or is 12 years younger than his brother, but it was a focused moment where that outburst of communication, that inner self, popped out in a super funny way. And I prefer that sort of format for myself, so that I'm not some vanilla ice cream my whole life, right? I like to have moments where I get off, and like I karaoke, right? So when I go up there and everyone thinks I'm soft spoken, which is, you know, which is my general average of the way I communicate, and I can belt out Led Zeppelin, or I'll do a LL Cool J rap or something like that, and I'm totally in it, man, in it to win it, you know. That becomes a performance that's interesting to people because I'm not that guy that would normally do that kind of stuff in their minds, right? So you can create these beautiful anomalies with your kids. You know, most people have a baby face. They have a baby. What I mean by that is when you're adults and you're all hard and you're survive the universe world, but then someone gives you a baby, and the kids totally got their eyes open looking at you, and you turn into that goofy kid that will do anything to make that kid laugh, make them feel comfortable, whatever, to protect them. And I think that that's why you need to, why it's valuable to look at sort of how you're behaving with your life, right? The other one is becoming very, very chastised, and it's really, really frustrating to me. And that is speaking correctly. I don't care what language you speak. If you're adopting this notion of what we call Ebonics in America, which was a way to convince ghetto kids to stay down. Oakland, California in the 90s came out with this sort of legislation to formalize Ebonics, which is essentially making every kid feel good about double negatives and horrible use of words, small vocabularies. They were essentially making sure that these kids in Oakland never got out of being anywhere. And that's why Bill Cosby came out and said, you know, we gotta shape up. Everyone needs to shape up, especially ghetto kids that have been convinced by these, albeit white politicians, to stay down. You need to have a decent vocabulary. Now, you don't want to overwrite things and over-communicate things. I've seen people who, again, have that fear of the lack of intelligence. They tend to write emails with the biggest words they can find. They pollute their resumes with giant, giant words. Anyone who gets into screenwriting who's like this, their stuff gets thrown away because it's just too hard to read. But I have a close friend of mine who has struggled to find work. Sweetest person on earth. Very intelligent. But and doesn't listen to the show, thank God. But this person, every time I talk to them on the phone, I'm getting ghetto speak. And in their mind, because I've mentioned it a couple times, because I've tried to help this person get a job, I've kind of, in my most genuine way, soft, constructive way, tried to say, you're not talking like that with the employer, right? You're not using ain't got no's and all that kind of crap with them, right? And I get this, oh no, I have a completely different voice when I talk to the employer. And then proceeds to have an hour-long conversation with me with all broken English. The truth of the matter is that that doesn't work. You cannot exercise horrible English and somehow convince an employer that you have good English. it doesn't work. And I'm willing to bet that this person has slipped to employers, and if they haven't have a half hour conversation during an interview, I'm willing to bet they've slipped a couple of those really bad double negatives out there to the employer, and they've lost their job. So my caution is, be careful what you use as slang, because you probably are slipping without even knowing it in your professional world, and then you're as only as strong as your weakest link, right? There's no other way the reality works. If you have a chain, you yank on it. If one of those links is weak, it's the one that's going first. And that is the constant of this universe, and that we have the same thing. And so we have to check all of our links to reality to make sure that we have the most level of success in communicating. And one of them is increasing your vocabulary and increasing your grammar, how you speak. Now, I've also seen people that talk horribly and post in Facebook, and they'll post just horribly spelled definitely with an A. That's a good one. I'm unaware of any derivative of English where definitely has an A. But if someone were to correct them, and Facebook's not really the place to do that, but if someone were to be in a situation where they try to say, yikes, that's not the word I don't think you want to use. And of course, you and you're on your telephone, you may hurt all ass on your phone, and you get it all wrong, you go back and edit it, whatever. They get very defensive about being corrected with grammar. Now, I was extremely lucky in that one of my grandmothers was a teacher for 36 years. And so in my house, you had to speak correct. My father has a beautiful vocabulary, he reads freaking libraries every year. So I got a lot of really good, not only my vocabulary, but my grammar. And, you know, there was a big deal when I was a kid where you would say, where are you at? And my father would say, right before the at, because you're ending your sentence incorrectly. I've even thrown out words to the best of my ability, like even. I try to use the word even. I just use it in one of my deep thoughts, but you'll hear me use it one time in an hour and a half. But even for me is going to be an argument of polarity. Is it even or odd? That's the only time I'm going to use even. But the thing of saying, he wouldn't even listen to me, it has absolutely no use in that sentence. Just get rid of it. Just, he wouldn't listen to me. Doesn't that sound better? They wouldn't even listen to me. What are you gaining from the even, right? So those little surgical corrections you can do inside your phraseology to help yourself out. One of the other big ones is someone starting off a sentence or reply with first of all. First of all is like saying, fuck you. That's what it's saying. First of all, you're an asshole. First of all. And I see this in technical manuals. I see this in, obviously, posts and communications with people. Never say, first of all. Never, ever say it, because it's a demeaning way to talk. Another phenomenon that Kyle and I have talked about is talking in questions. Adults are doing it. Now, this is a protocol for Ireland, and I think even Scotland does a little bit, where everything is in questions, which is an inflection at the end. When I ask you a question, it's like, well, did you take that out? Up. See how my voice went up? Now, if I'm saying, I took that out, I'm keeping a solid tone, right? But there's a lot of kids in America that are talking in questions, and they do it in this, and I would go to the sushi restaurant down from my street, and there's the question lady. And it's this woman who talks in questions. And it's very demeaning in a sense, because it seems like they're pausing to make sure that you can understand what they're saying, as if they're so off the scale and projecting advanced reality that I can't understand that I've, do you want the tropical tea? Do you want, or, you know, we've got this, we've got that. It's like statements inflected up as questions, right? Be careful. I don't really say that for you, the listener, because I doubt you personally do that, but track your children, because my kid used to do it. She started picking it up from school, and I have a really cool reply for that. And you just say, I don't know, are you asking me or are you telling me? I just need to figure this out. Is there something I need to answer, or are you telling me something? Because you're talking to me in a question. And so were you asking me or are you telling me? And then she'd restate the sentence without the inflection, and I broke it out of her. And anyone at the school who says that this stuff will naturally flow out of your kids' vernacular, do not believe it. Do not. You don't want your kids going all the way through their 20s talking like a moron and not getting jobs, and then when they're 30s, they calm down, and then they're just completely washed up. You don't want that. My kid also had a lisp when she was young. She gained it because she went to school with a bunch of kids that had lisps. And then the school kept saying all these, you know, it'll just, she'll figure out how to speak. It'll all work. Don't say anything. I absolutely engineered it out of my daughter. And we had fun with it. We had fun with how to say words. And again, she learned this by looking at other people and watching how the tongue formed. And she started copying it just genetically because she was forming her whole process of how to operate her mouth, right? And she didn't have it up till 6, and then she got it 7 and 8 or so. But we made it a really cool game, had a lot of fun with it, and she lost it. And her friends still lisp to this day. So parents, you need to be aware. And again, if you have one, that's all right. You know, you can do whatever you need to do. And a lot of people, it's funny, like all these famous people have lisps and you never know. Ice-T, the rapper, has a lisp. It's wild, right? The girl that played, there's a couple famous actors and actresses that have lisps and you never notice it, but for a split second, you know? So it's not like it's the end of the world. But if you have a choice, you want to re-engineer that one out. So this has been another very esoteric deep thoughts about communicating. I just wanted to open up the discussion such that you realize there's more minutiae and value to great communication, and there's great losses for not communicating well. As well, again, you need to build your reality and your friendship circles out of people that communicate like you, that have the same priorities that you have, that have the same executive summaries that you desire. If you're a very verbose person and you love just looking across that table at someone and hearing them talk for hours about nothing, then you have met your match. You've met your soulmate. Keep it. That's your style of communication. If you're loud and they're loud and you love it, then that's great for you. If you're quiet, be careful. Be careful if you don't like hearing your eardrums just socked in by a voice, right? All this is just to improve life. All this is to share notes about the unwritten laws of how we have to live our lives, right? And one of the things Kyle said in our first maiden voyage was to put the mind back in mind control. You know, mind control takes you away from who you're supposed to be. And MK Ultra Radio is about jamming back that foundation into you to heighten and aware all those things you had when you were a kid, to compare notes as adults that we have no guidance. We have absolutely no guidance as adults on how to live our lives. And so we have to compare notes. And this should be hopefully valuable to you. And again, please comment down below with anything that you've got. You know, we're not trying to beef up our views. I don't give a crap if these things get listened by 10 people, one person. As long as that person finds value in it, I'm totally cool, right? If you think this would be valuable to anybody, definitely refer it over. Because again, we're looking for more input from you guys. So the more people that see this, we get the input from you guys. This is not just a exercise in getting more YouTube whatevers. And again, for those of you who are listening through the podcast, just the audio version, these are in video. Look for the black and white videos on YouTube. Again, if you made it this far, big kudos to you. And I always say that because I think this stuff might be a little hard to follow to the very, very end. Thankfully, we do have feedback from people who have made it to the very, very end. If you haven't been to our website, go to mkultraradio.com. From there is everything, the podcast, the YouTube, all the good stuff. Please join us on Facebook. If nothing else, we filter the news for you so you can kind of see the BS. As soon as it happens, we're on top of it. We usually just find other sources and put it together like the Drudge Report. But as we always say on the conclusion, learn the rules that rule you. And remember, they're going to rule you no matter what. So you might as well know what they are. Peace out.